Hello everyone, Ben here. As you might hear, I sound like I'm about to make an extremely sleazy phone call, but I'm not. This sound is the reason why this week's episode is a little bit late, because I've got a chest infection. Yay! That my doctor got very angry with me about and said it might be mild pneumonia. Yay! It almost certainly isn't, but you know, it's fun to raise the stakes in the drama. Anyway, a very quick message to say thank you for your patience. I hope you enjoy this week's show, and as ever, if you feel like supporting us, you're very welcome to head to patreon.com/worstfootforward to do so. If you do so, then at the end of this week, we're gonna drop a special treat. We have started sending out the chapters of our book to literary agents. We've had our first rejection letters. We have now zeroed in on agents who represent authors who've written books similar in tone to Worst Foot Forward. So we're very excited for heading to those. So actually, you can do us a wee favour. If you've read any books that you think, oh yeah, this author's got the same sort of vibe as Ben and Barry, drop us an email, worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com, drop us a tweet, @worstfoot, and let us know. We might have already heard of it, but honestly, it's incredibly useful intel if you have a favourite book that links in with us. There's a brilliant author I love called John Higgs, who I'm going to be sending stuff to his agent. He's one. Greg Jenner, the historian, let's aim big. Obviously him, obviously No Such Thing as a Fish and that gang. But anyone who maybe you adore but we've not heard of, would be really useful if you knew that. Anyway, to celebrate that, the end of the week on Patreon, we're going to drop the introduction and the two chapters that we're sending off. We know we've previously given you little snippets of them, but we thought, you know what, you've supported us so much through all this year, and we've been keeping you up to date on the journey of the book. Our Patreon supporters, you can just have those for free. There's a strong chance that if we do manage to get a literary agent and a publishing deal, oh boy, are the editing scissors going to come out on those from the professionals. So you can get to enjoy the sweet uncuffed drafts with a fair bit of new material you won't have heard of on the podcast and a fair whack of stuff that you have, but in more detail. So that's our treat to you. And also, five more Patreon supporters, then we will have a pre-Christmas or New Year treat for you, which is where we will stream the Bela Lugosi Shonky classic Plan 9 from Outer Space on our Twitch channel with me and Barry co-commentating alongside it. So if five more of you want to hop on board the pod train and support us, then that's what will happen. I could yammer away at you some more about various evil plans. Oh, we have fun news for next year's live show. Oh boy, do we have fun news, but we'll tell you more about that next week. But now I am going to bathe in ginger, honey and lemon, and I'm going to let you enjoy this week's episode about the world's worst carer. And oh boy, could I do with some of the opposites of these ladies and gentlemen from this week. Hello, friends, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find us snootling away in moth-eaten armchairs here at Crazy Annie's Sleepy Nightshade Retreat, the finest care home in the land for retired podcasters and professional show-offs. We've already started the day with a wire wool scrub down and Russian military exercises before having gruel spooned into our mouths and used to fortify our creaking joints. Later on, various residents will be talking about which wars they'd like to pretend they fought in to give their recollections of their youth some sort of meaning, before we all meet in the Great Hall to read the catechism for the disapproval of young people just living their lives, having a nice time, and not bothering anyone. Ugh, disgusting. And trundling along beside me in his three-wheeled napping chair, tartan blanket up to his neck, and three ear trumpets in each lug hole, it's old Father McStay.
I think I'm already well-practiced for life in a care home, because I just love sitting around watching telly all day. It's my number one skill. and has been for the last year and a half.
The gap between a convalescing 96-year-old and a high-functioning student is paper thin,
yeah.
Or indeed a resting actor.
Yeah, well, like, when people give out to students, college students say, you know, you need to grow up. You're like, well, I have done. I've skipped early middle age and latter middle age, and I've gone straight to old folks' home. I've worked in an old folks' home for a little bit.
Have you?
Yeah, very early, like when I was in school as like a work experience thing. And I don't know whether it was a comment on me or a comment on the sort of the level of professionalism of the nurses and the staff, but they were just like, you can just help in the kitchen basically the entire week. I was like peeling potatoes, washing crockery, the whole thing. And there was me. I had visions of being like a sort of a figure of fun in the school, wandering around, providing entertainment, helping elderly people get breakthroughs, remembering things they had long forgotten, and holding hands as people passed away and leading singing circles. And instead, it was mainly running custard down the drain.
I think, to be fair, that being openly, flagrantly 18 whilst in a care home, it feels a little bit like you're trolling the residents.
Unavoidably 18. I'm proud.
Yeah, unavoidably 18. It just seems like a rude thing to do. Like, either that, or they'll take one looking and be like, oh, we don't want to excite the elderly residents,
yeah.
with this sprightly young buck here. Let's hide him away in the kitchen.
Yeah, well, let's introduce our guest, who has also worked in a care home, as well as being a comedian and writer. He is the creator and host of The Care Home Tour, a show that brings slapstick and interactive comedy to the residents of nursing homes across the UK. He also created and hosts Pope's Addiction Clinic, where comedians get confessional about their dependencies on stage. Now, I'm spotting a theme here, and I'm looking forward to Pope's Prison, a new stage show where comics are confined in hellish conditions, subsisting only on basic meals and allowed only a small amount of fresh air daily, or they could just go to the Edinburgh Festival. He has sold out shows, yeah. at that very festival, as well as at the Brighton Fringe, Vault Festival and Leicester Comedy Festival, and has been featured on BBC Radio 4 and recommended by Stuart Lee, which essentially ranks him alongside humanism and 60s jazz. His debut book will be released next year, called I'll Die After Bingo. It's a memoir about elderly care, drug abuse and comedy. An unlikely memoir for a Pope, but then again, we've yet to hear what Papa Frankie got up to in 1960s Buenos Aires. Either way, I'm delighted as an Irish Catholic and renowned pontiff botherer to welcome any Pope onto this show. So please welcome Pope Lonergan.
Hello! So you're one of the Catholics that loves the Pope. Thank God for that, yeah.
I mean, as an Irish homosexual and lapsed Catholic, I'm more intrigued by and irresistibly drawn to, in the way that people might have daddy issues, I'm very much Papa issues.
Well, it's weird you say, like, I'm, my dad, we come from Irish extraction, and my dad is actually Catholic, but I decided to go the Quaker route, so I'm actually a Pope who practices Quakerism, weirdly enough. So,
as a Pope who enjoys nice chocolate from the north.
Exactly,
of England.
Exactly. hello. I'm absolutely fascinated by the fact that you lived in a care home.
Worked in a care home. I do have a friend who lives in a care home or works and works that's, there as well. But yeah, they provided them a place to live
amazing.
In it.
Well, that's a bit like there's a Dutch model in certain places where they get students to board with. It might not necessarily be care home residents, but certainly people in the 70s and 80s, because I think they get cheap or free boarding, and then the elderly people get youthful, sprightly company. Not the sort that would overexcite them, like you, Barry, but the kind that will provide them gentle, restful stimulus in the autumn of their years.
Yeah, that place, it's they're firm believers in the opposite of reality reorientation, which used to be the standard in the 80s, where, like, they say something weird, you drag them back to your version of reality, going like, no, your husband's dead, June. Stop talking about your husband, he's dead. Whereas now they go, here's a fake husband, or like they...
My favourite thing, I think, What are you saying, that care homes are mostly investing in blow up dolls that they disguise as memories?
Exactly, as tangible memories. I know in that Dutch one they've created like shops and places. So if there's some that worked in retail, they can go in and they work in that shop, and it's kind of labor, really. It's slave labor. They still call it.
It's called Hogevijk. The dementia village.
It's
amazing.
It's incredible. It really is. And I'm someone who firmly believes in, like, we're dealing with dementia, that's sort of staying consistent with their version of reality. I mean, that's kind of a big part of what we do, just going to that very briefly, with like the care home tour, where like the basic premise is that we're an improv troupe where 3/4 of us happen to have dementia, and we're just there to kind of to facilitate interaction and provide stimulation. And we can do that by like whatever they're offering up to us, whatever they're saying, even if it's a, you know, very like aberrant sort of tangential thing, we just go with it. We just go with what they're saying, and it's always very rewarding, takes us into really interesting places. So yeah, I love doing that.
I think as well, from my experience of that, is that obviously when dementia is at its most extreme, it's very, very difficult to deal with. But when it's mild or moderate, my experience of family members with it is sometimes they will just fuck with you and they'll come out with stuff. You know, you're like, oh God, you're 80, whatever, and we know you've got dementia. Is the thing that you just said because of your illness, or are you just pissing about? Just to try and get a rise out of us.
The ones like the tricksterish, like mischief makers, the ones who basically want to do whatever they can to cause havoc, or you know, make the carers' life impossible. They're the ones I fucking love. Oh, I love them ones. I love them residents because
Yeah, they're the sort of people who want to watch the world burn and then will claim they've forgotten what matches are actually for afterwards.
Exactly. They've got a certain like nihilistic spirit to them. And yeah, I'm all for that. I love it. I'll just tell you a quick story in the care home tour. So one of the things was when we did it in Leicester Comedy Festival, Jos Norris, the incredible Jos Norris, who came and did it and loved it. He had this idea. It's like quite a conceptual idea that he was going to bring a box, an empty box, pass it round, and all the residents were going to put in the box their favourite memories or the things that they hold in their heart, that kind of stuff. But they misunderstood and they started loading their wedding rings and loop. and loose change into the box. What should have been a lovely afternoon become an inadvertent mugging. It was really funny. It's like they were like looking side to side, like, is this what's supposed to be going on? And all the carers were looking at us like, oh God, so we had to sort of explain, don't worry, you'll get your wedding rings back, just memories, nothing real. But yeah, and then one of the blokes got annoyed at the fact that we'd mugged him and challenged me to an arm wrestling match.
I thought you were going to say duel. Yeah, well, I was going to say, how old are these people?
He was good getting up there. I mean, he was 93, challenged me to an arm wrestling match. Looking back, I should have let him win for appearances, but I did not let that man win. Beat him fucking easy.
Anyway, you've got multiple skills, but we need to find out what you're not so good at, Pope. What are you worst at in the world?
I think the worst thing in the world is, I'm the worst at, is knowing what's relatable, which is a real hindrance for a comedian. And I'll give an example of why that is. So I come from a family who believes in, I've got an unapologetically bolshy Essex mum. She believes in complete transparency and full disclosure and just like letting it all hang out there to such an extent that she recently stopped a comedy show. There's a comedy show going on. She was in the audience, started a interaction with the comedian who which we all know as comedians can be annoying, but it ended up being fine. But apropos of nothing, she said that I was such a big baby that when she gave birth to me, her vagina looked like an unrolled sleeping bag.
Oh my word.
And that was like, she's not like, you know, she's funny she's funny, just like naturally funny, will say things. That wasn't, that was just off the cuff, which I was, that was amazing. But yeah, I suppose I've inherited part of that. And I remember once I went on a date and like 10 minutes into the date, she was like, oh, if you like, just sort of saying general questions to keep the conversation ticking over. And she said, if you had one wish, what would that wish be? And I've got a dog called Alan, who's like a little Bichon Frise, like lovely little bloke, love him to bits, good boy. And she went, if you had one wish, what would that wish be? I said, if I had one wish, I wish that Alan could process pain as pleasure so I could boot him around the room until he comes. I truly thought, I wasn't saying that to be like, oh, weird and idiosyncratic. I truly thought like she'd go, yeah, I kind of know what you mean with that. I thought the same thing. And she just, she didn't even find it funny.
To Pope, you know that meme that's been going around on Twitter of the someone saying something and then the red flags?
Oh, yeah, I know.
Someone who went on a date with you once has tweeted that with a load of red flags.
At least I make it easy, though. At least I'm like, I mean, that's 10 minutes in. She doesn't have to waste any more time. So,
directed to the point. And,
that is a really good approach to dating. Just 10 minutes in, drop a Molotov cocktail, and then see whether there are any survivors afterwards, and then he can continue.
Someone says, I'll have an olive in mine. I thought I'd read about Misery by Stephen King to begin with.
Great.
I thought that Annie Wilkes is quite a poor carer, all in all. For people who don't know the film or the book, based on the 1987 Stephen King novel, and then the film stars Kathy Bates as Annie Wilkes, who's a nurse and a huge fan of an author, Paul Sheldon, who's played by James Caan. And Annie finds Sheldon has a car accident in the mountains near where Annie lives, and she finds him and takes him into her home and starts caring for him, but eventually it turns into a hostage situation where she's torturing him and then begins to kill him because he lets her know that he's going to kill off her favourite character from his books, Misery Chastain, which is where the title comes from. Appropriately enough, Annie is seen as a metaphor for Stephen King's own well-renowned drug problem in the 80s. the dependency that he shows and it her being his biggest fan. And in an unrelated fact, at a Misery screening of the film, King was enjoying himself so much he yelled out, "Watch out, she's got a gun," during the film's climax. obviously, as I say, Kathy Bates won an Oscar for it. Can you imagine anyone else playing that role?
Oh, that's a good question.
No, because, but this is the point where you tell me the original screen test was done with Danny DeVito in the role.
Not quite, but Bette Midler did turn down the role.
Yeah, that would have been a good choice. Yeah,
I mean, she called herself stupid for doing so.
I mean, you say that, Bette, but I don't think that what that role needs is more tits and teeth sass.
Yeah, you break my legs. and then the role was played on Broadway in the last decade. Bruce Willis and Laurie Metcalf were the starring duo. And the James Caan role, several actors were approached. In fact, James Caan doesn't seem to have been in the top 10 performers they wanted for that part. Kevin Kline, Michael Douglas, Harrison Ford, Dustin Hoffman, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Richard Dreyfuss, Gene Hackman, Robert Redford, and William Hurt twice all said no to the role of Paul Sheldon.
I thought it'd be for an actor quite. It's a lot of actors always talk about wanting to sort of get back to the stage and get back to theatres. That's what really helps them to flex their like acting muscles. And I suppose because of how little interaction is with any other characters outside those two, as far as I remember in the film, I thought it'd be like it's quite stripped down and like pared back, isn't it? I thought that would be a kind of like almost like a return to theatre. I don't know.
I wonder if that's why so many people weren't keen on it. They thought it was didn't really seem like a film at the time. And in fairness to him, when James Caan was casted, he ended up being furious when he realised he was going to have to be in bed for most of the 3 months
shooting. Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, he's quite a restless figure, James Caan, apparently. And Rob Reiner, who directed it, informed him he had to stay in bed.
Oh, yeah.
Reiner obviously is known for, you know, comedy more so than his dramatic films. And he actually watched every Hitchcock movie in preparation for the for directing this. How do you think they did the bit where his legs get hit backwards by the sledgehammer?
Isn't it called knobbling in the thing or something? Isn't it got a name?
Yeah,
to,
something like that.
How do you think they did it? I reckon they just put a pair of trousers on like a plank and then
apparently,
that's how my wife describes me getting dressed in the morning.
Ben's 4x2. Paul's legs were made of gelatin with wires running through them into prosthetic ankles. And so when she hits them with the sledgehammer, the wires give them a little bit of, you know, flex and resistance so that they bend at a really gruesome angle when she hits them with the sledgehammer.
Oh, is that gelatin like as in, so it's not like jelly? I think
more like plastic explosives. Not literally explosives. That didn't make her smash explosives with a sledgehammer.
Yeah, the bomb in the ankle the whole time.
Yes, it's a dramatic it's a very drastic version of the cyanide capsule in the teeth. Then I read a bit about another type of carer. I read about royal wet nurses, because it's a long-standing tradition in the British royal family to have wet nurses, because breastfeeding was considered, you know, uncouth for, you know, the queen consort. And also, I didn't realise this, but there was a belief that if you were breastfeeding, then you couldn't conceive. So obviously they wanted the queen to get back into air-bearing mode as quickly as possible.
Sorry, how did they believe that the royals conceived? I'm just thinking now that oil royal sex just involved the tit wank, and they were like, I presume this is how...
We need these elsewhere. Excuse me, baby. No, apparently this is... I then went on the NHS website, and it does say, indeed, if you look up contraception and breastfeeding, you're unlikely to have any periods if you breastfeed exclusively... brackets, give your baby breast milk only, and your baby is under 6 months old. Because of this, some women use breastfeeding as a form of natural contraception. This is known as the lactational amenorrhea method, or LAM. So yeah, it seems like these batshit medieval doctors were onto something.
There's actually as we know, there's lots of different strands of Islam and lots of different types of religions, and Salafiyah, which is known for being quite a very kind of conservative, hardline form of Islam. There was a cleric who issued a pronouncement or whatever, saying that one part of the Quran, his interpretation was that the only way you could talk to people at a certain time was if they were your kin or a family member in some way. And he found a loophole, which was that women who worked in mixed gender workspaces have to breastfeed their male colleagues, because it says in the Quran that the breast milk is what connects you and makes them become your kin. Right in Salafi Islam, breastfeeding work. That was actually, but a lot of people said this guy was obviously nutty and just wanted to suck a bit of tit at work. But it was something I read the other day. I thought it was quite...
That is a remarkable B road that I did not expect the journey of this conversation to go down.
Amazingly, you know, history is littered with nameless women and women who are overlooked in favour of, you know, all of the dick-swinging men. But we know a lot of the names of royal wet nurses. Richard the Lionheart's wet nurse was a woman called Hodierna. Charles I's daughter
was Richard Lionheart's wet nurse to be called something like Bessie the Lamb.
Yeah. Well, that's a nice biblical reference, Ben. I like it. Charles I's daughter was fed by Lady Dalkeith. It was sometimes a position given to a sort of an aristocratic woman, because they sort of thought you could pass on, you know, traits to the child, so they would, you know, go, well, she's of particularly good bearing and good temperament and all of this stuff. Queen or James the Sixth of Scotland, he became King of Scotland when he was a year old. His mother was Mary Queen of Scots. He was given over to a wet nurse, Lady Rares, and Killigrew, the English ambassador to Scotland, first saw him at the age of one, because he was king and had to be visited by the ambassador. So the ambassador visited this one-year-old being breastfed by Lady Killigrew and had to presumably do homage to him. And in the 18th century, doctors were suspicious of breast milk and sort of suggested that maybe mothers should avoid using it entirely. So Mary of Medina, who was the mother of James Stuart, was told by her doctors that, oh, well, the baby is sick and what you've been doing wrong is you've been breastfeeding him. So stop breastfeeding your sick child.
Was that Dr. Nestle who was looking after her? Yeah.
Well, thankfully somebody thought, you know what, maybe we should secretly breastfeed the child. Yeah. And they brought in a local tile maker's wife to feed the baby. She was brought in so quickly, she was still wearing old shoes and no stockings. She just shoved her feet into whatever pair of shoes she could as she left the house. And it's likely her breast milk saved James Stuart's life.
Wow.
And he responded to that by, if it's the monarch I'm thinking of, killing a lot of women he accused of being witches.
Well, history has turns on so many dimes.
You've got to have a, yes. You've got to have a stag do, though, haven't you? You've got to have a stag do.
Yeah. And some wet nurses were really well treated. Henry the Seventh, he was the father of Henry the Eighth, but his older son was Arthur, Prince of Wales, he called the jewel of his household. Arthur had to be weaned when he was about 2 years old, but Henry the Seventh made sure that his wet nurse was well cared for. He said she must be, you know, she'd have to have her food tested for poison when she was breastfeeding him, and then also have a doctor standing by just in case. So just in case anyone tried to poison the child through the wet nurse.
Wow.
And my favourite one was a woman called Genevieve Poitrine, Madame Poitrine, who was the wet nurse of the Dauphin of France, Louis Joseph, the son of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. Hers is my favourite case of nominative determinism because Poitrine means breast or bosom.
Amazing.
She was 31 years old when she took over the role in 1781. The previous wet nurse had apparently... The baby had developed a rash, so they fired the previous wet nurse and brought in... Genevieve Poitrine, and a courtier said, Madame Poitrine, who had large breasts and according to doctors excellent milk, her rustic looks contrasted with the obsequious urbanity of the courtiers. And she had the tone of a pomegranate, swore with great ease, and was neither surprised nor moved by anything. She accepted royal lace and linen without embarrassment, and only asked that she not be made to wear powder because she never used it. Poitrine left the service a couple of years later and had a pension of 6,000 livres as well as pensions for her children as well. So she was, yeah, she was very well cared for in the aftermath. But I just love that they just went, we need someone to breastfeed this child. Well, this lady is called Mrs. Breast. Bring her to me. But is she from the town of Brest in France as well? Yes, why not?
I mean, surely you'd hope as well that she was one of a pair of twins.
Yeah. Please, don't call me Mrs. Breast. That's my mother. But my favourite, I'm going to the world of emotional support animals and service animals for my world's worst carer.
Great.
Obviously, in the last decade, we had an explosion of service animals appearing. Usually in America, it seems, these stories of various different animals appearing on planes, turkeys and monkeys and squirrels and snakes and peacocks. Usually the story in the papers would be about someone being refused access with whatever animal that was their support. In 2018, there was a woman flying out of Newark Liberty International Airport who was banned from flying when she tried to bring her emotional support peacock with her, even though she offered to buy the peacock its own seat. But the airline said that the peacock didn't meet guidelines due to its weight and size. A lot of airlines had various different requirements that they had to be a certain size, they had to be able to fit under your seat or in your lap. Basically, American Airlines, for example, said lap animals must be smaller than a two-year-old child. One of American Airlines' rules that I really enjoyed was that animals may not eat from tray tables.
That is a good rule. Can I just say, does that mean that I'm not allowed to have a three-year-old as my emotional support animal?
Well, they make a distinction between an emotional support animal and a pet as well, because you can have emotional support and service animals for free on a plane. but pets you have to pay for. So I don't know where children fit. Are children emotionally supportive, or do you treat them more as pets? There was a real story of snakes on a plane in Anchorage, Alaska in 2017. A passenger lost their snake on the previous flight, and so passengers on the next flight were told by the pilot as they were taking off, "Guys, we have some snake loose on the plane, but we don't know where it is." Basically appealing for calm and just a keep an eye out announcement. And the 5-foot snake, pale yellow, wasn't venomous, but was found by a boy climbing on his seat. So the one time a child climbing on their seat on an airplane is useful. Yeah. And they found it, and the pilot came back and had a short chat with the flight attendant. Then the flight attendant managed to grab it and drop it in a plastic trash bag and kept it, obviously, as you do with bags on a plane, in an overhead storage bin.
Of course.
It's amazing. Yeah, the cutest one is became quite famous as well. October 2016, Daniel the Duck. He used to fly with his owner, Carla Fitzgerald. She was battling post-traumatic stress disorder. She had an accident in the early 2010s. And it helps her sense oncoming panic attacks. And they're emotional support animals are amazing. They can sense when you're being triggered, or they can look for little signs of panic and attacks. And he puts his head on her chest to sort of basically tell her it's time for you to lie down and just relax for a little bit. But Daniel went on a flight with her. The entire plane was delighted, apparently. Fitzgerald said, "Everyone took notice of him and fell in love. He's an adorable, funny and sweet little guy. He was very well behaved at the airport and during the flight. I can imagine he was helped by the fact he was dressed in red shoes and wore a little Captain America diaper." So she had considered not making, you know, a mess up and down the aisle, which is very, very good of her. Now they've banned them in America, emotional support animals on planes. The US Department of Transportation changed the rules. This is in the dying days of the Trump administration. They got in there before they left office. They don't accept emotional support animals on planes. The only ones, they'll only be treated as pets from now on. And the only support animal you can have on board for free is a dog. They didn't make an exception for guide horses, though, which are increasingly popular. Are you aware of this?
A guide horse.
It's quite ungainly, though, isn't it? You know, it's quite a big.
Well, you don't. It's not a full size horse, to be fair.
Fair enough.
you get miniature horses, and there are lots of benefits to them. In fairness, they live much longer than dogs, 30 to 40 years. So you can obviously be with your owner for a longer period of time. They're very calm, which is why police and, you know, various different militaries down through the years, if you have had horses as part of them, they're quite. Well, relatively capable of remaining calm in crowds and loud spaces compared to dogs. They don't get easily confused for pets, which a lot of guide dogs do, because you don't see a horse and say, oh, everyone has those as pets in the way you do with a dog. And they've got, you know, 350-degree vision, independent eye movement, which is useful for when you're guiding someone around. They don't get fleas, they shed a lot less, and they're much less emotionally needy than dogs.
Yeah. but are these full-size dogs? Horses, or are they?
No, Ben. You know, it's a Shire guide horse. I just put him on his lead.
One chair for the horse, one for his dick.
Just take the chair out. Yeah, and I'll sit on the horse. No, it's miniature horses.
Okay, good.
So, like, you know, Shetland pony sizes. And even smaller. There's one who has its own. Obviously, there's several, I'm sure, that have their own Instagram account. But I encourage people to go and check out Flirty the Mini Service Horse on Instagram, who has over 13,500 followers.
I mean, if I was employing a service horse, the one thing I wouldn't want them to be is flirty.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Flirty is adorable and takes an excellent photo. But there's a you can buy a book about it. The Guide Horse Foundation of America was founded in 1999. You can read the book Helping Hooves by their founder Janet Burleson. But I'm picking for my worst carer Britain's first guide horse, who was specially trained to help a man called Mohammed Salim Patel, who was a journalist, and he particularly needed a different support animal because he has a fear of dogs, which is another benefit of guide horses. And so, guide horses exist in America. Why don't we try pair you up with this American miniature horse called Digby, who was 29 inches when they got hold of him. And the standard size for guide animals is 30 inches. So great. Perfect. And then Digby had a growth spurt.
Uh-oh.
he grew up to 33 inches. And Mr. Patel said, "It's a kick in the teeth. As time went on, we were going into supermarkets, offices, and it was more of a squeeze. I would be knocking things over on shelves and walking sideways to accommodate both of us." Which, the man has a degenerative eye condition, but that is objectively hilarious to think of as well.
I thought you were going to say, "It's a kick in the teeth because the horse actually kicked me in my teeth."
Yeah, the horse became too big. It has a happy ending because, you know, he doesn't get, you know, melted down for glue or anything like that. Sad ending is Mr. Patel.
No, you shouldn't do that to the visually impaired.
Mr. Patel, who works as a producer with the BBC, was gutted that Digby wasn't going to be his guide horse and he'd formed a bond with him and so on. But he eventually was placed with someone in London, a worker in the Office of National Statistics, decided to take him on. And
of course he was, because we all know how much horses enjoy counting, so you just hear out of out of the offices of the Office of National Statistics, and how many children were born in the county of Rutland in April? Clop, clippity-clop, clippity-clop, clippity-clop.
My favourite bit about that is obviously he was moved to London. Mr. Patel had lived in Blackburn, but the Office of National Statistics is in London, so the horse was relocated to London, which would mean taking her to work on the underground. So he had to be trained for train travel, and they did that by taking him on Ben. They took him on the Tyne and Wear Metro in Newcastle.
I'm sorry, I just imagine being on the metro and looking over and seeing someone with a horse and just going, "Well, that is a very ambitious time traveler."
Yeah.
It's either that or seeing someone with a seeing eye horse on public transport and is thinking the glitch in the matrix has got so large you can literally walk a horse through it. Preposterous.
Well, there you go. I'm picking Digby, the little horse who could until he got too big and then he couldn't.
I was reading an article recently called A Decent Death by Stephen Sedley, and it's about the idea of assisted suicide and the legalities of assisted suicide, and goes into kind of philosophical discussions about whether it's a form of care, whether, you know, we should be inflating like two different things, like encouraging someone to kill themselves and then just, you know, helping someone to do it who has, you know, in their reasoned mind realized like they want to draw a line under this sort of this material realm because, you know, it's become a horrible life for them. But there's a bit at the beginning of the article is just quite sort of funny and interesting. And so it's got a kind of a loose connection to care, and I suppose there is a form of care too. But the law of England and Wales, Scotland's law, is not in all respects the same, has come a long way in my 1982 years, said the author. He said, "Absurdly and cruelly, until the 1961 Suicide Act was passed, it was a crime to kill yourself. While those who succeeded were beyond the reach, the law's reach, those who tried and failed could be sent to jail." And they said, in fact, by the mid-19th century, the law had got itself into such a tangle that a person injured in a failed attempt at suicide could be indicted for wounding with intent to kill, an offence for which Parliament had thoughtfully provided, you guessed it, the death penalty.
Amazing.
I suppose it's like the courts as a form of a crap form of care. There's no not giving any care there. So that was one of them, and the other one was a more kind of personal story. It was so someone at one of the care homes I worked in. I've got to be careful how I don't kind of talk about this. I don't reveal to you. At one of the care homes I worked in, one of my colleagues, what we do with residents, when residents need to be weighed, we sit them down on like a weighing scale so they're secure. So it's a chair, you sit down and it does your weight. And we had been doing that with the residents that we needed to weigh. And then, you know, we escorted the residents up to the lounge so they were all safe and secure in the lounge. And as we went back to the room, empty room, with one of the weighing scales, my colleague noticed that there was on it, like, this is a bit disgusting, but there was a cannonball size feces in the toilet, right? A phenomenally large feces.
That is, did they use that exact term? Because I didn't realize that we sort of applied the caliber measurement to turds.
So it was just, yeah, it was just, yeah, it was kind of astounding. So in his infinite wisdom, my colleague decided to put gloves on, still going to stick with hygiene standards, no mucking about, put his hand in the toilet, pick up the feces and deposit it onto the weighing scale to see how much this feces weighed, right? Don't know why he felt compelled to do that. Call it natural curiosity. That's what happened. I was sort of saying, probably not a good idea. We're going to have to just clean down the chair. And he was like, I need to know how much this
I love
weighs.
That. I must know. I must know. We will. Yeah.
But when he deposited it down like that, the management walked in the room. And so they walked in. Just imagine this, like, poo slumped on the chair like an oligarch on its holidays or something. And me and my colleague just sitting there, like, hands on our hips, looking down, going, oh my God, it's 4 pounds or 4 milligrams or whatever. Right, so we're both looking like that. We obviously get pulled in to the manager's office to do initial statements. Haven't had time to prepare or anything. I just was like, look, I wasn't really involved in this process, but you know, I should have stopped it. You know, I should have intervened in weighing the poo, but I decided to be a passive observer of weighing the poo, and for that I am eternally sorry. Blah blah blah. He came up off the top of his head saying that it was, as a matter of right of possession law, he could lay claim to ownership of the disembodied poo. Because once the poo was ejected from the body, it was in the public domain. And that was his defence for weighing the poo, that he now owned it. It didn't belong to the woman anymore.
What an incredible time to shout finders, keepers, losers, weepers.
I know!
Yeah!
I know! It's just like, he must have gone through this legal argument in another context at some point, because I don't know how he came out of it off the top of his head. And then they said, well, if you're sticking with that, you have to write all of that in a statement, which he did with citation. It's fucking mental. I think he ended up getting like a disciplinary or something like that. But yeah, I was kind of impressed with that on the spot bit of like covering his back. So, I mean, that's bad care work. But it doesn't, you know, it's not the worst thing in the world. It didn't directly impact residents or anything like that. It was just kind of, and there's a certain amount of kind of curiosity that I find endearing and slightly redemptive about it. But still, it was just something that happened in my care home. So bad care, but yeah, good, interesting brain from my colleague.
To begin with, I'm going to talk about someone who I imagine any self-respecting consumer of 21st century culture / nerd will despise. And this is a person called Kaya Morgan. And Kaya Morgan was a New York memorabilia dealer. Gentlemen, if I were to tell you that a New York memorabilia dealer was acting as a carer for a gentleman in his 90s, a couple of years ago, which gentleman in his 90s would you not want him to be caring for?
Should we shout out?
In
their 90s?
Stanley?
Correct.
Oh my gosh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, so when Stan Lee was widowed in 2017 on the death of his wife Joan, apparently multiple men tried to attach themselves to Stan and his various businesses and try to manage his affairs. And Kaya was chief among them. He was arraigned for charges including false imprisonment, forgery, and fraud. In the application for his restraining order in June, he was accused of isolating Stanley from his friends and family, exploiting their relationship to embezzle artwork, cash, and other assets worth more than $5 million. Oh. And I know, it's awful, isn't it? There were several erratic Twitter posts from Stanley's account that Morgan was accused of taking control of, as well as a surprising $1 billion lawsuit launched by Lee against Power Entertainment, the company that he himself set up in 2001. Stanley later dropped the lawsuit in July of that year, calling it confusing. It's really sad what happened. Morgan, of course, denied everything and said it was completely false. And another thing he did, all the thing he did, he pocketed more than $262,000 from autograph signing sessions, where basically he was, to all intents and purposes, using Stanley as his own ventriloquist doll.
Oh, God.
And, yeah, really bad. I mean, he I hate to say when you go, people look like a wrong'un, but... Oh, he does kind of look like one.
And how did he get to know Stanley in the first
place?
Well,
I think he was an actor as well. And I think he worked, as I said, in memorabilia as well. So,
yeah, he does look like... He looks like he should be in Succession or something like that. He's got kind of this oily kind of... Yeah, he does look like a wrong'un.
Yeah, he does.
That's coming from an expert.
Yeah, yeah. As a fellow wrong'un, I went...
Not a happy suggestion there. But then, similar to you, Barry, rather than looking at wet nurses, I started looking at regents. So obviously when a royal comes to the throne in their minority, so under 18, they are looked after by a regent. Perhaps the most famous ones in British history are the regents for Edward VI, Henry VIII's son, and that was Edward Seymour, the first Duke of Somerset, and then later John Dudley, the first Duke of Northumberland. But they are a pair of Mary Poppinsies to the ones that I found elsewhere in history.
I like that you said Poppinsies like crises.
Oh, that is how you pluralize
a Poppins.
So a brief one before I come to my lengthy suggestion. I found Queen Dida of Kashmir, who was a 10th century monarch. She did away with her own grandsons on her way to gaining sovereignty of the kingdom. During her husband's reign, she seized a hold of administrative control, becoming regent for her son and grandsons. And she killed her grandsons using medieval forms of witchcraft and torture and went on to rule for 23 years. However, I am not going to talk about her. Instead, I'm going to talk to you about a sultana. A sultana is the name for a female consort of a leader of the Ottoman Empire. And I'm going to talk to you about Sultana Kürzem, who ruled in the mid-17th century. Now, she was brought to Istanbul as a slave in the 1600s, and she was part of the harem of Sultan Ahmed I. But on Ahmed's death, she maneuvered his mentally ill brother Mustafa onto the throne in order to control him. And at this stage, she was already Ahmed's favourite concubine. And Kürzem was not the name that she was given. She was originally from Greece and, as far as I can see, had the name Anastasia. But the name she was given, Kürzem, means leader of the herd, because clearly her husband went, she's one savvy lady. And even as early as 1612, a Venetian ambassador, Simon Contarini, described her as a woman of beauty and shrewdness, many talents. She sings excellently, is well beloved by the king. Not that she is respected by all, pay attention to that, gentlemen, but she is listened to in some matters and is the favourite of the king, who wants her beside him continually. So she manoeuvres Mustafa onto the throne. But he is quite quickly deposed by his nephew Usman, and Kürzem at this stage just retreats into the background, into the Ottoman court, and not much is heard from her until 1623, when her son, Murad IV, becomes sultan. This is because Usman was murdered by his own Janissary slave soldiers in the interim. And this is a big part of Ottoman court politics. If there is a brother or a husband or a father that you can have murdered by your own elite Republican guards, essentially, that's gonna happen.
It's just no one even gets mad. It's just like, yeah, well, that's just politics, isn't it?
Milk bottles. It's just
Yeah. Well, it's just like, don't ask how the sausage gets made in Ottoman politics.
Absolutely true.
And don't ask which of your siblings is in the sausage.
Also extraordinarily true. Murad allows her to be in power from 1623 to 1632. However, Kuzem's era of control ends in 1632 after Murad has a removed from the political scene. He decides not to allow any power to interfere with his administration of the empire and cuts Kuzem off from her contacts with his statesmen and threatens to exile her if she doesn't comply. As you can imagine, she does not take this well. And also, she was clearly a very good stateswoman. After she leaves power, Murad's sultanate disintegrates. The Safavid Empire invades Iraq, which the Ottoman Empire controlled at that time. There are revolts in northern Anatolia. And once again, the Janissaries, the slave soldiers, storm the palace and kill his grand vizier. Fearing suffering the same fate as his elder brother, he doesn't assert his power. So, what happens next? Following the recapture of Baghdad, Kuzem becomes a key factor in this and sort of surrounds his son in the triumph and tries to bask in the glory of this. And as she journeys out of Istanbul to welcome the returning soldiers, her carriage is draped in gold fabric, the wheels are studded with gold. She is preceded by high-ranking religious authorities riding incredibly caparisoned horses. In fact, there are 12 additional carriages following her procession. In the final few years of Murad's reign, Kuzem manages to convince him not to murder his sole surviving brother. Basically going, don't do a normal Ottoman emperor thing.
And that was the thing. Everyone was like, well, this woman's weird.
Yeah. Exactly.
She ain't making sausages today. Fucking burgers.
Yeah.
She takes power again in 1640 when Murad dies and is replaced by Ibrahim, who again is not the most mentally stable of men. Is this because of inbreeding? Is it because it's just a requirement of being an Ottoman royal? It's hard to see. It's hard to sort of work out. And apparently Murad's dying wish was to have his brother Ibrahim killed, which is an odd dying wish.
Yeah. Do you have any regrets in life? Well... You're staring right at me.
And apparently Ibrahim, as mentally unwell as he was, clearly was a little bit with it because he had to be persuaded by both the Grand Vizier and Kuzem to take the throne. He was like, I know what happens to people who take this throne and I do not want to take it. And he had to be persuaded by Kuzem, brought out his brother Murad's corpse before him to go, it's fine, he's dead, you're going to be okay. So eventually, Kuzem persuaded her son Ibrahim to take the throne by distracting him with girls from the harem. And Ibrahim had the nickname.
sorry. Hate to interrupt the three-way. Just can you sign this?
Yeah.
What is it? Don't. It's nothing. Just sign it, and you can get back to what you're up to.
Yep.
Gosh, you must be very cold.
Yeah. Well, you talk about gosh, you must be very cold. He had a particular love of overweight women and women who wore furs of sable and lynx that gave him the nickname Le Fou de Fourrure, or basically the king of the furs. Kuzem would just be regularly supplying him with virgins and overweight women covered in furs.
Was he an Ottoman early model for a furry?
Oh, yeah.
The furry community. He's a pioneer of the furry community.
Yeah, very much. Let's not kink shame an Ottoman king.
No, I'm just delighted to find its roots go back much further than I thought.
She also appeared to bring a proto-version of Rasputin into her court, a gentleman called Chinchi Hoka, who was a minor religious figure with apparent occult powers, was brought in to apparently find a cure for Ibrahim for his ills. And she awarded Chinchi Hoka with the chief justiceship of the land. And as you can imagine, this went down like a 4-pound cannonball of feces in the Ottoman court. Eventually, this chap was quietly murdered by some Janissaries who were like, we're not having any of you around.
At least it was quiet.
Yes, at least it was very quiet. By 1648, Qusem was struggling to control both the Janissaries and Ibrahim. She agreed to surrender to the Janissaries if they promised not to murder Ibrahim, but to imprison him instead. Ibrahim was dethroned, seized, and imprisoned, as only a royal can be, in a palace. And Qusem gave consent to this, saying that, you know, that the whole society relied upon this. However, the new Grand Vizier petitioned for a fatwa to sanction the execution, and it was granted with the message, if there are two caliphs, kill one of them. And Qusem basically went, yeah, all right, fine, you can kill him. It was reported that Ibrahim's last words were, is there no one amongst those who has eaten my bread who will take pity on me and protect me? These cruel men have come to kill me. Mercy, mercy. And he was strangled.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He should have just asked, my dying wish is that my mother be killed.
Yeah, yeah. After that, Qusem stays in power for her third regencyship, and this is for her seven-year-old grandson, Mehmet IV. Now, obviously, she cannot ply him with virgins and overweight women in furs. Well, she could, but Mehmet might be feel a little bit overwhelmed.
Just a juice box and some Pringles.
Yes.
Maybe a little baby, maybe a baby. Yeah.
Apparently, when...
Can you imagine having to negotiate with a seven-year-old?
I know.
It's either going to be so fucking easy, you just let them watch My Little Pony and they let you invade, you know, yeah. Greece. Or it's going to be the most hardcore negotiation, high-level yeah. stakes. Stubbornness will kick in. There's no middle yeah. ground.
No.
Yeah.
So apparently, she ruled... Mehmet would be on the throne and she would be hidden behind various veils to the side of him, basically whispering what to do. And when...
Is she basically puppet, like, ventriloquism?
Pretty much. The way she presented Mehmet to the court was she said, here he is, see what you can do with him. She continued to be incredibly powerful at this stage. She accumulated a massive fortune through tax farming, owning and leasing commercial buildings, investing extensively in various economic activities, and she became known as the Great Valide Sultan, the Great Grandmother. She eventually succumbed to a plot from Turhan, who was the mother of Mehmed. I don't feel have been one of her daughters-in-law. In 1651, clearly, when Qusem decided that she'd had enough of her own grandson and was going to attempt to poison him with some tainted sherbet.
The perfect crime,
yeah. Turhan tipped off the Janissaries, and the Janissaries and her eunuchs went to her apartment and... attacked Qusem. Qusem tried to hide in the closet, but a bit of her fabric was seen hanging out the door, and she was dragged...
Sorry, it's turning into a Walworth farce now. Gonna try and murder this child with sherbet. She's hiding in a wardrobe, but her dress is hanging yep. out.
And she was dragged out of there, and she was murdered by being strangled with her own curtains.
Wow.
Complicated woman.
There are so many little details in that. Turhan, was yep. that the daughter-in-law, shows up with actual soldiers to murder her. And when they get there, they go, oh, do you know what? Let's not get these swords all messy. Let's actually strangle her. Has anyone got a rope? No? Yep. No? How about our shoelaces? No, we wear sandals. Well, there must be something we can strangle her with. Curtains. Did they take the curtains off the rails? That's what I want yeah. to know.
You've got to hope they were loop ones, not those fiddly little plastic things.
Yeah.
as an amuse-bouche before the assassination, when they got to her chambers, they found an old woman who served as Kersem's buffoon. And that woman was armed with a pistol and said that she was actually the Valide Sultan, that she was Kersem and there was the woman they were looking for, and they killed her first. So before strangling her with her own curtains, they killed her clown.
They killed her...
Who had a gun in the room that they could have used.
Them, but they knew that the gun would have a flag in it with the word bang on it.
Yeah.
They killed a clown with dementia, which ties up this perfectly. Fucking perfect.
Our choices for the world's worst carer are Barry's suggestion for the United Kingdom's first guide horse, clippity-cloppeting away across various public transport networks in the UK, Digby. Pope's suggestion is for the anonymous turd weigher of a care home. And mine is for the indomitable Sultana Kersem, who used various sons and grandsons to hold on to power for upwards of 25 years. Oh, it's tricky. I can't pick the horse because the horse was ungainly. But as far as I understand it, did his job well.
Yeah.
But at too large a size.
Yeah, he was too caring, too large. And caring.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I think. So it's between your maverick pal who weighed a cannonball full of poo.
Yeah.
Not a cannonball full of poo.
He handled that cannonball poo with grace and tenderness. I mean, he was very warm towards that massive lump of stonking shit.
I just can't help imagining this care home having cannons on the ramparts trying to repel greedy family members who were trying to alter wills of the residents.
Yeah.
On my mark, unleash hell.
I think I am going to go for Sultana because murder, I mean, murder's pretty rough, pretty heavy. Yeah.
It is pretty rough. It's quite nice having a woman as a nominee in this because very often this show is basically the history of bad Nazis, bad evangelist Christians, and they're all men. Yeah. So it's nice to have a bit of girl power, isn't it?
Yeah.
So a remarkable figure, but also a bad mum, a bad grandma, a bad carer, a bad regent. So Sultana Kersem it is. Before we go, it is time for the world's best news this week, which we will keep doing through this rickety winter of COVID. And we go to Tamworth in the Midlands, where a gentleman by the name of Andrew Carvel has got into the spirit of Christmas by building a pirate ship in his back garden. This pirate ship is 9 meters long, 2 meters wide, and according to Mr. Carvel, just fits in his garden. It is absolutely terrific. Like, it has got a huge skeleton as the figurehead, Jolly Roger on it, a spider in the rigging. It is absolutely magnificent. And understandably, he said, like, all the kids nearby love it. And it puts... I'm hopefully going to decorate the outside of my house with my son on Wednesday for Halloween. And this is the first time I've ever done it as a artistically illiterate Jew. But... I can only hope to be anywhere near as good as this. I hugely recommend you look this up. Obviously, any North American listeners will take one look at that and go, amateur. But speaking as a Brit, it's really remarkable.
Cool. Oh, I want a pirate ship in my garden.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Before we go, Pope, where can our listeners find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
Find me on Twitter, Pope Lonergan. My book, I'll Die After Bingo, a funny memoir about elderly care, drug addiction and comedy, all sorts of shit in there. That comes out. Yeah, you can pre-order it now on any good bookshops and book buying sites. I recommend going to independent bookshops and ordering it in. That will be coming out properly in June. And I've got my own podcast, which is Pope Lonergan is Plimmin and Lompin. And one final thing, on the 9th of December, at 2 North Down, I'll be bringing back Pope's Addiction Clinic, the 9th of December at 2 North Down near King's Cross station. So, yeah, there's a few of the bits I've got coming up. So, yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been such a bloody lovely time. It's been a real pleasure.
You're very welcome, my friend. Well, we're all off to find out how many of my children I need to murder in order to get hold of the Dulwich and West Norwood parliamentary seat in the 2024 election. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.